Well, if you've been here with us as we've been going through the book of Hebrews, you'll know that several of the last chapters of Hebrews and the next few chapters to come as well have all been talking about the same theme. They've been talking about the high priest. And if you were here last time, we were looking at Hebrews, you'll know that we got to the end of chapter 7 when we had this wonderful picture of this great high priest. Let me read a few words from Hebrews chapter 7, page 1066 and verse 26. It tells us the ideal high priest, you might say. Verse 26, such a high priest was fitting for us, who is holy, harmless, undefiled, separate from sinners, and has become higher than the heavens, who does not need daily, as those priests, to offer up sacrifices, first for his own sins and then for the people's. For this he did once for all when he offered up himself. So this is this great picture of the high priest that has been described for us. A high priest that is different from all the other high priests throughout all of history. This one is different. This one doesn't need to offer sacrifices. All the other high priests did. They'd go to the temple week by week, day by day, and they'd offer these sacrifices on behalf of the people. This one doesn't need to do that anymore. Why? Because at one time, he offered the one great once-for-all sacrifice. He offered himself. And the writer, of course, is talking about the Lord Jesus Christ. He is the great high priest who, verse 26, has become higher than the heavens. And the reason why this high priest could do that was for the reasons that we've got in verse 26. He alone is holy and harmless and undefiled and separate from sinners. You see, any of the priests that went before, they could have died. In fact, we're told there in Hebrews, the very obvious, they did die. They all died. But their deaths were not sufficient as a sacrifice. Because the sacrifice that needed to be offered needed to be a perfect sacrifice. And those other priests were men just like us. They were imperfect. They were defiled. They were unholy. They were joined to sinners. They were sinners. That's why this one was so different, this Jesus Christ. And then as we go into chapter 8, you might be left thinking, well, what can the writer add to that? What else can he say? He's got another two or three chapters to go about the high priest. How can we go beyond that peak? Well, he says, doesn't he, in chapter 8 and verse 1, now this is the main point of the things that we are saying. It's as if all those chapters before were just introduction. Now this is the main point. This is the really important bit. So if you've not been here for those other seven chapters or you've missed a few along the way, don't despair, because this is the main point. This is the one that really matters. So what's the main point? What's been all this build-up about? What's the writer really wants us to get hold of? Well, he tells us in chapter 8 and verse 1, this is the main point of the things that we are saying. We have such a high priest. That's the main point. Because what he's been telling us before is that this high priest exists. He's telling us about him. He's describing him. He's showing how different this high priest is from the other high priests. And it's vital that we understand that as a foundation. But what he's saying now in chapter 8 is the main point. And the main point is that we have such a high priest. This is not a high priest who's serving others. This is not a high priest who is in another temple somewhere else ministering to different people. This is our high priest. We have a high priest like this. And this high priest is seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heaven. Why was this point so important that we have a high priest like this? Well, do you remember, those of you who have been here as we've been going through the book of Hebrews, who this book was written to? It was written to Jewish Christians who were suffering difficulties and persecution and who at least some of them were thinking, well, is it really worth it? Is it worth keeping on as a Christian? You see, these Jewish Christians were able to think, Well, I'm not a Gentile. It's not that if I stopped being a Christian, I'd go back to being a pagan. If I stopped being a Christian, I'd go back to being a Jew. And Jews are God's people, aren't they? So if I stopped being a Christian, I wouldn't lose very much, would I? Because I'd just go back to being a Jew, just like Abram was, just like Moses was, just like David was. They all had great things. They all followed God. I could go back and be just like them. So why should I carry on? Why should I persevere with all this Christianity when I've got so much that I can just fall back on? That was the mindset. You can perhaps understand it a little bit. Well, this chapter then, chapter 8, with the whole of Hebrews, and particularly this chapter, is designed to address those concerns. And I want you to imagine, as we look at these first six verses of Hebrews chapter 8, I want you to imagine that you're a Jew like that. And I want you to imagine that that's how you're thinking. You're thinking of going back to Judaism. You're thinking of giving up Christianity and going back to Judaism. And if you were thinking like this, I think perhaps there's maybe at least three, probably more, but at least three things that you might say as reasons why you'd want to go back. Here's the first reason. You might say, well, Judaism is such an important part of my culture. It's such an important part of my culture. You know very well, don't you, that the Jews, perhaps more than any other religious group at all, are really fixed on the Jewish land, the land of Israel, aren't they? And that's their home, they believe, given to them by God. And for Jews, this idea of land and the people and this geographical area are so important. And there's all these other things that are part of what it means to be a Jew. And here, these Jews might well be saying, well, Judaism's such an important part of my culture. I can't leave it by hand. I kind of belong to this. This is where I grew up. This is where my roots are. This is where my heritage is. And yes, I may be scattered now and out of the land, but like all Jews, I'm hoping to go back to my own land, to my own place. That may well have been what some of the Jews would have said. Well, the writer here wants to quash that. He wants us to understand that no, that's not relevant here. What does he want us to understand? Well, look at chapter 8, verse 1. We have such a high priest who is seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens, a minister of the sanctuary and of the true tabernacle which the Lord erected and not man. He wants the people to understand that Jesus' priesthood is different from the priests that they used to in Judaism. Jesus' priesthood is not an earthly priesthood. It's a heavenly priesthood. Do you remember the role of the priest in the Old Testament and in Judaism? The role of the priest, as it were, was to come between man and God. The idea was that God was so holy and man was so sinful that the man couldn't go directly to God because this barrier of sin was in the way. So what they do instead is that the man would go to the priest. The priest would offer sacrifices for sin. And the priest, as it were, would be in touch with God, and the priest would be in touch with a person, and via the priest then, the people could have this experience and knowledge of God. That's very roughly how the Old Testament worked. Now, what's the writer to the Hebrews is saying is this: well, here's your priest, and he was there, as it were, in between you and God. But what's happened to this priest? Well, this priest is now a heavenly priest, so he's now in heaven. So it's as if the writer is saying that the middleman has gone. You no longer need to go through the middleman in order to get to heaven. You've got this access into heaven because the priest is now a heavenly priest. He's not an earthly priest, but a heavenly priest. And you in Judaism might think this land and all these other things and the temple are also important and also significant. But how much better, how much important is heaven than this land that you see around us? And to know that our high priest is not an earthly high priest, but a heavenly high priest. Doesn't that help to put your Judaism in perspective? Doesn't that help you to understand these priorities? Doesn't it help you to understand that Jesus' priesthood is so much better than the priesthood of Judaism? Well, that's maybe the first thing that a Jew might have said if a Jew in the first century. But maybe there's a second thing that might have been said. Maybe they would have said, well, my Judaism, my faith is so meaningful, so meaningful. How can I give up all that meaning? Grown up with it, all these ceremonies that we've gone along to, and the Day of Atonement, and the sacrifices, and the unleavened bread, the Passover, and all these things, it means so much to me. It means so much. Well, I think it's to that objection that the next few verses are written in Hebrews chapter 8. Because in Hebrews chapter 8, verse 3, we're told this. We're told that for every high priest is appointed to offer both gifts and sacrifices. Therefore, it is necessary that this one also have something to offer. For if he were on earth, he would not be a priest, since there are priests who offer the gifts according to the law, who serve the copy and shadow of the heavenly things. As when he was about to make the tabernacle, for he said, "See that you make all things according to the pattern shown you on the mountain." So here's the answer that the writer is given. That Judaism is so meaningful. So no doubt understands what people are saying. All these rites of passage, all this, all these signs and symbols. There are many people today, perhaps in, say, a church like the Roman Catholic Church. And they have all these, and they have all the hats and the shepherd's crook and all the outfits and the garments and all these different things and the rosary beads, and they'll say it's all so meaningful. There's so much meaning in these things. But what the writer wants us to understand is that these things are mere symbols and shadows of the reality. And Judaism is so meaningful because it points to something greater. It points to the reality beyond its shadow. So Judaism does have meaning, yes it does. But there is greater meaning in Christianity. There's greater meaning in the fulfillment of Judaism, that is. Because Christianity actually accomplishes what Judaism requires. Christianity delivers that Judaism was never able to do and never designed to do. We'll come on to that in a moment. Yes, there's meaning in the signs and symbols, but only signs and symbols. In Christianity, in Christ, it's the reality. Well, maybe then there's a... this Jewish Christian, he would have said that Judaism is such an important part of his culture. He might have said that Judaism is so meaningful. Maybe he would have said also that Judaism makes such wonderful promises. Maybe he would have said Judaism makes such wonderful promises. And it does, doesn't it? We'll come on a moment to what the writer does in the rest of the chapter is he contrasts the old covenants of Judaism with the new covenants. The old covenant represents Judaism, the new covenant represents fulfilled Judaism or Christianity. And there's much in this old covenant which is glorious and wonderful. Now, there are lots of covenants in the Bible. If you've ever read the Bible, you'll see there's lots of different covenants, and sometimes people get a little bit confused. Well, what is the Old Covenant? And is there more than one covenant? Well, what we can think an old covenant and a new covenant. And that's why it's a little bit tricky to answer the question, how many covenants are there? Because you've kind of got this one covenant, but within the one covenant are two covenants. It's a little bit tricky. And then those two covenants are at times repeated at different points of the Bible. And what we can think of it is that the Old Covenant was the covenant of the Old Testament. It was a covenant that was in force and actually active in the whole of that Old Testament time period. The New Covenant, spoken of then, but didn't come into effect until the end of the glorious doings of Jesus Christ, his coming to earth, his righteous life, his death on the cross, his resurrection from the dead, his ascension to heaven, and the sending of his Spirit. At the accomplishment of that, the new covenant came, and we read about that in Acts chapter 2. So we have this old covenant and the new covenant. And here the writer wants us to understand that when he's talking about the old covenant, he's talking about the covenant that was given to Moses. We know that because of chapter 9, and if just jumping ahead slightly, and verse 19, for example, talks about that covenant that Moses had spoken of, which is a reference back to Exodus chapter 24. Well, what was this old covenant? Well, as I said, there's many different places where the covenant is reiterated in the Bible, but perhaps the clearest place to see the old covenant is in the book of Jeremiah and chapter 7. I'll just turn there quickly, because that's a really nice short summary, and I think short summaries are often helpful, aren't they? So Jeremiah chapter 7, verse 23. Here's a kind of summary of the old covenant. This is God speaking. He says, "Obey my voice, and I will be your God, and you shall be my people. And walk in all the ways that I have commanded you, that it may be well with you." That's a pretty good summary of the old covenant. Obey my voice, and I will be your God. Walk in all the ways I've commanded you, that it may be well with you. Now, the problem with that covenant, it's a great covenant in many ways, isn't it? Well, what a lovely promise from God. And you can well imagine why the Jews thought, well, Judaism makes such wonderful promises. I mean, the Old Testament is full of promises like that, of God's care for those who follow him and those who obey him. They're wonderful promises, really glorious promises. But as Jeremiah points out in verse 24 of chapter 7, they did not obey or incline their ear, but they followed the counsels and the dictates of their evil hearts and went backward and not forward. That's the great problem. And time after time in the Old Testament, you have these renewals of the covenants, and maybe a king or maybe a priest or a scribe or somebody will realize that, no, the nations turn their back on God, and God sent judgment in order to win them back, and God has shown them the error of their ways, and through this priest or king or whoever it may be, all the people are got together, and it's explained to them, look, you've abandoned God. This is what's happened to you. In battle, or all your crops have failed, or whatever means it is for God to show them that they're going down the wrong road. God uses these means, and then he calls them back. And time after time in the Old Testament, we have the people, we renew the covenant. This time's going to be different. This time we're going to obey. This time we're going to actually keep the law. This time we'll experience the blessings of this covenant, because this is going to be different. Let me give you an example. There's dozens of them. Ezra would be one example. Josiah would be another example. Josiah found that the book of the law, that the people had gone so far away from God around about 600 or so BC that they lost the Bible. I mean, that's how bad it got. They lost the Old Testament, and then it was found in the reign of Josiah. And he reads this, and he seems as though he doesn't know its content, at least in detail before, and he suddenly realizes how far the people have gone away. So he gathers all these people together. He's genuinely repentant. There's no question about that. His heart is right. But so many of the others around him were just kind of going through the motions. They were just saying the words. They didn't really mean it. Their hearts were not changed. And so even in those days, so much was missing and so much was lost from this nation. You see, that was the old covenant. It really did offer wonderful promises. And I'm sure if this Christian Jew was to say, Judaism makes wonderful promises, then the writer to the Hebrews would have said, yes, it does. But look at chapter 8 and verse 6, because here's the answer to that objection. But now he, that's Jesus, has obtained a more excellent ministry, inasmuch as he is also mediator of a better covenant, which was established on better promises. And notice what the writer does here. He doesn't write the old covenant off of as meaningless and worthless. He doesn't say, that's a rubbish covenant. He doesn't say, that covenant's going to do you no good at all. He doesn't say that. He implies that it's a good covenant, but the new covenant is a better covenant. I'm sure he would have agreed with the Christian Jew who said that Judaism makes such wonderful promises. He'd have said, yes, it does. But fulfilled Judaism, Christianity, makes even better ones. And the great point of these first six verses here for us in chapter 8, as these Jews are maybe thinking about abandoning Judaism, abandoning Christianity rather, and going back to Judaism, is to say that you'll lose so much and gain absolutely nothing. Because our high priest is a better high priest than Judaism has. Well, that's all very well and good if you're a first century Christian Jew thinking of going back to Judaism, but that doesn't describe any of us here this evening. I trust the principles have been helpful. But the rest of this chapter now, verses 7 through 13, I believe really help and come even closer to home than those first six have done. Because these next verses seem to suggest to us something more, something different. If the first six verses were written to help those Christian Jews who were thinking of turning their back on Christianity, it seems to me that these next easily be applied to people who are not yet Christians, people who are not really sure about what Christianity really is. And it may well be that in this gathering of Jewish Christians, there may well have been people there in the church, as it were, who were Jews, but not yet Christians, maybe sympathetic to Christianity, but weren't yet actually Christian. And it seems that this section here was written with them particularly in mind. And therefore, for those here this morning who are not yet sympathetic to Christianity, maybe have been thinking about Christianity for many years, perhaps even, then this. I think the writer does, he answers objections. As I've spoken to people over the years about Christianity, and maybe you're talking to people about Jesus Christ, a question I love to ask is, well, why aren't you a Christian? Why aren't you a Christian? What is it that stops you becoming a Christian? Sometimes that completely floors people. I'm reading the testimony of a man not that long ago who was an atheist, and somebody asked him, well, question. His answer was, well, nothing would convince me, and he realized that actually he had a closed mind. Well, what is it that's stopping you becoming a Christian? Many people don't have an answer to that question. And if you don't have an answer to that question, I suggest to you that you either ought to become a Christian or find an answer pretty quick. Why won't you become a Christian? But there are some people who do have an answer to that question. Let me suggest some of the answers to that question and show you how these verses in Hebrews chapter 8 help to answer that question. But there may be some people who would say, well, I can't become a Christian because I won't be able to keep going with my faith. This is something that many people have said to me. They look at Christians and they see actually that being a Christian's pretty hard. Those of you who are Christians will agree with that, I'm sure, won't you? It's not become a Christian. It's not easy to continue as a Christian. And they look at the struggles that we face, and they think, well, I'll never be able to keep going. I'll never be able to manage to keep on. If we look at verses 7 to 9 of Hebrews chapter 8, I hope that helps us a little bit. Here's what it says. For if the first covenant had been faultless, then no place would have been sought for a second. But finding fault with them, he says, we'll just pause there for a moment. We'll read the rest in a second. So here the writer is comparing the old covenant of Judaism with the new Judaism or Christianity. That's what I'm preaching to you, the new covenant tonight. Now, the first covenant, the old covenant, had a fault, as it were, you might say. It had a fault, because if it didn't have a fault, verse 7, there'd be no need for a new covenant. Well, what is the fault with the old covenant? What's wrong with the old covenant? Well, what's wrong with the old covenant, verse 8 tells us. What's wrong with the people with whom the covenant is made? That's the problem. From God's point of view, it's a great and a glorious covenant. It's a wonderful promise that God makes, and God keeps his side of the bargain. The problem is the people, because they keep failing. So can you see, verse 7 warns us that there might be a fault in the covenant, but verse 8 tells us that God finds fault with them. Not with a covenant per se, but with the people of the covenant. That's where the problem lies. The problem with the old covenant. We can't keep it. So if you're somebody who says, well, I can't become a Christian because I won't be able to keep going, you should really identify with these Jews who couldn't keep going in the old covenant. But look at what verse 8 says. Behold, the days are coming. Those are the days in which we now live. Behold, the days are coming, says the covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah, not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day when I took them by the hand to lead them out of the land of Egypt, because they did not continue in my covenant and I disregarded them. So here we have a contrast. You see, the old covenant made with their fathers did not continue it, verse 9 says very clearly. But this new covenant, beginning of verse 9, is not according to that principle. This is a different covenant. This is not a covenant that is dependent on our obedience. We need to understand this absolutely clearly. Christianity, fulfilled Judaism, is not a covenant, is not a faith, is not a religion that is dependent on our obedience. So if you feel this evening that you can't become a Christian because you won't be able to keep going, then it's a false premise. It's a false argument. Of course you won't be able to keep going, but that's not what the covenant's about. The new Judaism, difference in humanism and Buddhism and all these other religions, because this faith, this religion, this belief, this truth is not based on your obedience or on mine. Well, that's one objection maybe that the writer fires down, that you won't be able to keep going. Second objection that you bring, maybe you'll say, well, I can't become a Christian because I'm not religious enough. I have so many people have said that to me. Well, they perhaps think of go to church and do all these different things, and I think, well, I don't enjoy going to church particularly, and I don't really know any of the hymns, and I can't pray, and the Bible's boring. I'm just not religious enough to be a Christian. It's all right for religious people, but it's no good for me. I'm not religious enough. Well, it's that thing that the writer brings down to us next in verse 10, because he tells us that this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, says the Lord. I will put my laws in their mind, write them on their hearts. I will put and write them on their hearts. So if you've got the objection, I'm not religious enough, what is the writer saying to you? Well, he's saying this. He's saying that this covenant, that this faith, it's not about outward religion. That's not what it's about. It's not about fulfilling these various different things that you have to go through. It's not about this. This is an inward religion. This is a religion, a faith that promises inward change. This is something where your mind will be changed, because you'll have God's laws put in your mind. God's laws will be written. And in the culture in which this was written, that means you'll be a whole new person. Your mind and your heart, that was you. That was who you were. And God says here, in this new covenant, your mind and your heart will be changed. It's not about outward religion. It's internal change. And notice who does the change, verse 10. This is not about making yourself religious. Verse 10, I, God says, will put my laws in their mind and write them on their hearts. God does. It's not something that we somehow bring up in. can't become a Christian because you won't be able to keep going. That's not what this is based on. It's not based on obedience. If you can't become a Christian because you're not religious enough, that's not what this is about. This is about inward change, external religion. Third objection you might bring, well, I can't become a Christian because I don't understand enough about the faith. I don't understand enough about the faith. Again, this has been said to me many, many times. Well, if I understood the Bible as you do or as other Christians do, then maybe I'd become a Christian. But I don't understand this. Or heaven, or what happens when I die. And I don't really understand how it was that Jesus' death paid for my sin. And I don't really understand why. To know everything. And here in this passage, the writer says there's one. Shall know me from the least of them to the greatest of them. You see, Christianity is not about passing some kind of Sunday school test, whereas if you get 10 out of 10 on all the difficult, tricky, doctrinal questions, then you can go to heaven. If that was the case, then there wouldn't be hope for many of us. But that's not what Christianity is about. Christianity is not about knowing facts. Christianity is about knowing. Christian, that they know God. And what we want to do this evening and what we want to do every time we preach the gospel is to introduce you to Him. Know Him. You need to come to Him. And they shall all know me. And you see, verse 11 teaches us here that none of them shall teach his neighbor and none his brother, saying, know the Lord. Now you see, what the writer is telling us here is that you can't kind of become a somebody else. It's not that I can know the Lord and somehow magically pass that on to you or pass that on to my children or whatever. It doesn't work like this. This is a personal, individual thing as we come into the community of God's people. This knowledge has got to be personal. One of us is not, do you understand enough? The question is, do you know the Lord? Do you know Him? Do you know Him? I can't become a Christian because I won't be able to keep going. I can't become a Christian because I'm not religious enough. I can't become a Christian because I don't understand enough. Nonsense, says the writer on all three counts. And maybe the final one, and perhaps the most common, I can't become a Christian. Can't become a Christian because I'm not good enough. Verse 12. Here's what God says to those people who think that they can't become a Christian because they're not good enough. For I will be merciful to their unrighteousness and their sins and their lawless deeds. I will remember. I can't become a Christian because I'm not good. What the Bible teaches us is that God's mercy is greater than your sin. God's love is greater than your righteousness. And if you come to the God of the Bible, if you come to the one true living God, you find this, well, you're not good enough, but He will accept you anyway. You probably don't understand enough, but He will invite you to know Him. You're almost certainly not religious enough, but He promises internal change. And you definitely won't be able to keep going. But this promise is not dependent on your obedience, but on His grace. So how would you answer the question? I'm not a Christian. Because maybe that there are people here this evening who used to be able to answer that question, but can't answer it honestly any longer. If you don't have an answer to that question, probably a very good sign that God is calling you to Himself, even tonight. What does God want from you? He wants your all. He wants you simply to come. He wants you to acknowledge your unworthiness, that you would ask Him to forgive you. And everything that is promised here, He will do for you if you come in repentance and faith.